This will had come about in the most suspicious circumstances you could possibly imagine.
Who gets what when someone dies, and who decides?
The difficulty with undue influence often is proving it.
Join me, Damien Carrick, for the Law Report special series on wills, Over My Dead Body.
The person felt like they had no option, that it's difficult to prove that.
To hear, search for The Law Report and look out for Over My Dead Body. Find it on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal land. I'm David Marr. That there were for a long time in this country hospitals for whites and hospitals for blacks is, alas, no surprise. But in corners of Australia, like Wyndham in WA, this system of medical apartheid continued into the late 1950s and early 1960s. Later, we're looking at the fate of the Wyndham Native Hospital. But first, there are those who reckon this century really kicked off with the punk musical Hedwig and the Angry Inch, the tale of a genderqueer East German rock and roll singer, first on the stage and then on the screen, all over the world. The man who played Hedwig and wrote the show and a number of shows and films since calls himself these days a punk queer grandpa on a mission to bring back punk. Your homework is to stop cancelling each other, he's told students across America. Find out about punk and get laid while you're at it. His mission now brings him to the Melbourne International Film Festival for an anniversary screening of Hedwig on Friday, and to the Festival of Dangerous Ideas in Sydney this coming weekend, and a number of other gigs, the details of which will all be up on our website. John Cameron Mitchell, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you so much.
When did we start getting pure?
What do you mean?
When did this notion of purity and cancelling and disdain for kind of...
I blame Christianity. It's another form of it. Cancellation and political correctness from the sort of leftist point of view had great intentions of justice, of, you know, suspicion of capitalism, of like anti-fascism, anti-racism, which are the same goals of punk originally. Just the tactics were wildly different. And punks never thought of purity being possible. You know, there was an understanding that we are complex and flawed creatures. But the strange kind of Christian thing of like that people, let's say, a bit more liberal-minded require their leaders to be absolutely pure as the driven snow. People on the right are happy not to read the fine print. They're happy to let daddy figure it out, to trust is rarely mum, but sometimes mum.
Yeah.
Maggie Thatcher and such, Pauline Hanson. There's plenty of people who just say, I don't want to think about it. I like your hair. So you decide, Mr. Trump or whoever it is. And of course, it's strange that he sometimes, you know, Trump, this sort of venal billionaire with a silver spoon in his mouth, convinced a lot of poor working people that he was the one to take care of them. And, you know, you're not free unless your health care is torn away from you.
That's right, because you will be so much more energized.
Energized and free without any of this government interference.
By going bankrupt.
And you can go, you can die without anyone else's help, and that is freedom.
But before we
get into that,
before we go there, so you've been going across the campuses of the United States.
Yes.
You've been talking to students.
Yeah.
And you've been addressing the cancellation culture, et cetera,
right.
Et cetera,
and, and slow-boil fascism, as
okay,
I call
it. What's slow-boil fascism?
It's the Trump way. It's the slow, incremental crushing of institutions, of norms, to amass wealth, to degrade fact, right? That's the fascist playbook, is first you say, facts are all questionable now unless they're my facts, right? That's a, you know. And in our case, we had this strange coinciding of aspiring fascist with digital culture. And digital culture has reduced our attention span so much so that we're like, oh, look over there. We've got we've got a fascist in charge. We can't pay attention. Other cultures, if they're not happy, shut it down with a general strike. I'm thinking of like Bangladesh. I'm thinking of other countries that actually removed their venal governments through people saying, no, we're not working anymore. We're all out in the street. Very hard to do in the U.S. with digital culture, people reading the only the news they want to read. And Trump, in his own way, has managed to play that game without actually ever sending an email or a text.
I've only got about 8 things to take up there from what you've just said. But first, let's go to attention span.
Yeah.
Very familiar argument you're putting there. Yeah. On the other hand, there has been a triumph around the world of a film that lasts over 3 hours about Ulysses.
Ulysses.
No, not Ulysses.
Odysseus.
Odysseus, yes.
It's the same person.
Oh, please,
That's the Latin name.
We try to be culturally respectful on Late Night Live. No, but I make the point that there's so much rhetoric about the attention span being destroyed, and yet we are watching long movies, we are watching series that go on for years on television. That's contradicts the argument, doesn't it?
It does, but it also, if you notice, when all news is fake, let's say when you get such authority, like Trump saying, well, anything is fake unless he says it, right? That's sort of how he said it. But when you're in a situation where all facts are degraded, what do we have left? We have stories. That's all we have left. And it's almost the only thing everyone can agree on, that we want to lose ourselves in a hopefully fictional and non-fictional worlds. And that can be even a meme, and it can be, or it can be the Odyssey. It can be a TV series. Young people, though, are not watching TV anymore as much, in the U.S. at least.
They've got their phone.
They've got the phone, they've got TikTok, they've got games, they've got all kinds of other stuff. They might go see the Odyssey, but they're not rushing to it necessarily. The older people are. But basically what I'm saying is we have time for stories. We don't have time for facts as much anymore. So when people debate, you know, well, my facts say, no one can do that anymore, right? Because everyone has their own set of facts. Even with global warming, climate change, 90% of scientists say this is real and it's man-made. But one person will be cherry-picked to justify Trump's absurdity of, like, let's promote oil
But John.
Yeah.
In the end, aren't we going to value the facts that protect us?
Yes.
The facts
that we want.
Well, not necessarily the ones that we want, but the ones that will save us.
I would hope so, but I also see people using them to justify abuse of certain groups of people. I can see people using their facts, fake or not, to just, oh, this one guy said, oh, maybe renewables are not a good idea. We make decisions based on facts. But lately, as the facts keep changing or are only used by the people who want them, we have stories. And stories are narratives that can affect us. Some might be art, some might be pure propaganda, some might be conspiracy theory, right? All stories are true now. Every conspiracy theory is now true. You have a problem with them when you
cry pain from here, yes.
And nobody believes just one. If they believe one, they tend to believe almost all of them. Also, what happened to the irrational belief of people secretly trying to help you? Why is it always secretly trying to hurt you? Are you saying that we are all evil? Anyone with any kind of influence is evil?
No, so impossible.
I don't think that's true, but I also know that money corrupts too. And I have found that with Hedvig, with Shortbus, with other things that I've been part of, now that I'm on this tour, 25th anniversary of Hedvig, I am meeting people who said that story, not tooting my own horn, but I'm more in shock that so many people have said to me, it changed my life for the better. I caught it at a certain time in my life. It put me down a certain path. Same with Short Bus, which uses explicit sex in a non-pornographic way, in a human way, I hope. And people said, it took me away from that porny, dehumanizing part of sex and put it back into people's lives. So that was useful for me when I was young. These are the stories I'm talking about. This is my whole job, is taking a fictional story and talking about stuff that I care about that might be useful to the moment.
How does punk rescue us from this confusion of fact and story?
Well, punk is just one way. We talked about the more liberal sort of, some might call wokeness, and now we're talking about woke one and woke two. I don't know if you've noticed that, which is funny because woke one had no sense of humor, no flexibility, and you were out. You were canceled if you didn't fit in. Even, you know, AOC in the U.S., one of our socialist, you know, rising stars, says woke one was a little crazy. We got carried away with the letter of the law as opposed to the spirit of the law, which was fairness. And identity politics, to me, again, good intentions, started siloing us, separating us from our natural buddies, so that someone could sweep in and grab the election, because we were separated. We wanted purity. We wanted Kamala Harris to be pure as the driven snow, never made a mistake in her life. And in that case, it was Gaza that was her blind spot, according to people. Since she said nothing about it, though she really had nothing to do with it as the vice president, but she didn't speak out against Israel's excesses. Therefore, she was out. But I'm like, okay, guys, but people can be educated. And what's the alternative here? If you don't vote for her, who wins? Trump. We get very impractical with our purity, our litmus tests. I'm a practical person. I'm hopefully an empathetic person, too, that is fair-minded and understanding my limitations. But it's like punk, again, is not just a hairstyle or a kind of music. It's a way of making things with your friends who might be from wildly different walks of life, genders, races, whatever, outside of any system we are told is valid. And that might include social media, digital culture. Certainly it means Hollywood and those structures. But it's making stuff that challenges those things in a collaborative way. That is punk. And you can have right-wing punk, skinhead punk. You can have queer punk, which came up during AIDS. You can have the UK version, which was very much about the working class.
You know, is the common element defiance?
I think the common element is thinking for yourself. It's grab the guitar whether you can play it or not. It's DIY, NIRL. Punk dissolves in the digital ether. It can't just be in the ether. Then it just becomes another fashion thing. Punk has to be in the real world. And I was just at the Punk Rock Museum, which almost sounds like a...
What?
I know.
A punk rock... Where?
In Vegas, of all places.
Well, now that makes sense.
It does make sense. But it was still inspiring, despite its, you know, anarchist convention... comedy, you know, like juxtaposition is like, is it punk to have a museum? To others, including the punk who built it, it is, because it reminds people there were other ways of being that weren't just tied up with money, the way things are, the way you're supposed to do it. So to me, the job of youth is to be punk, meaning to question the status quo in a way that doesn't care about whether you feel offended. Safe, the whole idea of definition of safety. I feel unsafe because you're speaking loudly. I feel unsafe. You know
it
what
happens at universities? Up there are students who feel unsafe.
Exhausting.
John, they feel unsafe.
They should be physically safe, mentally unsafe. That is education. And I tell these kids who have not heard that, the teachers can't even say that because one complaint and they're out. And they're my age. They're saying, John, kick their asses with love. I'm like, guys, get the hell out of this chair and be a 20-year-old. Take a risk. Find out what's going on. Get laid. Help somebody out. Build a community garden. These are all punk. Question the status quo in a way that is not mediated by sponsored content or institutions, because those can be corrupted. So do it on your own.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I am talking to John Cameron Mitchell, punk queer grandpa, creator of Hedwig and the Angry Inch. which is celebrating its 25th anniversary. John, I want to circle back to the question I asked to begin with about the drive for purity.
Yeah.
Put a theory to you.
Christian, remember.
Yeah, you say Christian, but let me put a theory to you that there were, perhaps even are, a number of groups in society who have been very, very badly done by.
Yep.
Often by Christians.
Yep.
And there is a sense that they are owed something, that they are owed protection, respect.
Reparations.
Reparations of some kind. And that this demands a sort of hands-off respect.
And a leg up sometimes.
Mm-hmm. But as a result, public debate, public action becomes mired in this, you know, have we shown enough respect? Have we, you know, is that the right way of talking? Is this my story to speak, etc.? Yeah. That the basis of that, though it's kind of, you know, grown in outrageous ways, the basis of that is actually kind.
Yeah. Because those were solutions to the problem being that the same type of people were controlling every narrative. The cartoon being the straight white guy. And again, even in colleges, being the straight white guy was a liability for a few years. And I'm like, guys, don't paint this straight guy in your class as, you know, the person who caused historical pain throughout the centuries. You don't know this person. Don't paint them with the brush. Then you're imitating your oppressor when you do that, by judging someone from the cover of their book. It's like, we as outsiders, we as people who have been judged by what we are, what we look like, even what we're hiding about ourselves, outsiders, have a great privilege in life. Not the most obvious privilege. The people who got everything, you know, on their plate at the beginning, the ones who didn't have to fight for stuff, it's not their fault. But a lot of those people are limited because they become very literal. If everything is handed to you, as the golden boy, let's say,
yeah,
things are what they look like. When you are judged, say, by, a closet case as a kid. When you're judged by something you're hiding, you understand from a very early age that there's a surface to things and there's layers underneath of reality. If you have the power, you are literal. You don't understand the complexity. And when you have to deal with real life, which is complex, you crumble. We all know those people, their best years were in high school, right?
Oh, yes.
And the Misfits were not their best years. But they learned something, if it didn't kill them, they learned something later that made them much more interesting, much more able to deal with life. Even in families, the queer kids always come in and save the day at the end because, not to say that the straight folks are helpless, but they're mired in the gender roles that they have. They don't have the skills to deal with the complexity of the world. And
whereas the queer kids do.
Because they've had to themselves. Also, usually they don't have as many kids.
That's true.
And they look younger for it.
That's true.
But those people are the ones who have, they've learned some skills. And that privilege of outsiderness allows you to see things more clearly, I find. And if you don't take advantage of that privilege and you end up imitating your oppressor and saying, you're with us, you're against us, you're black or white, nothing is black or white. As soon as someone says always or all or every time, I reach for my revolver because it's never true. It's never black or white. And let's say more right-wing people want it to be black and white. Like, it seems to be They want it to be simple. They want it to be like the Bible, which is not simple and is deeply contradictory.
Yes, yes.
But to me, the complexity of the situation, the variety of human development, even the fact that queer people do exist in a natural variation way, just like redheads do, why is that so threatening to people? You know what I mean?
And it is still threatening, you think?
It's still threatening. Why is a woman, let's say a cis woman like J.K. Rowling, finding that her actual state in the world is threatened by a trans woman? What's that zero-sum way of thinking? Yes, that trans woman have had a very different youth from you as a cis woman, and they call themselves a woman because they feel like a woman. That doesn't take anything away from you, Ms. Billionaire, who seems to use this as her main program for those billions.
Mm, yeah.
I mean, she's helping other people in other ways, but like, really? You're the spokeswoman?
Aren't we going to look back on this time and its obsession with trans?
It's so absurd.
Weird.
It's weird.
Really
that that
weird.
Is the problem. And it's a wedge issue. They're coming for your kids. You know, queer people have always been an old-fashioned scapegoat, just as immigrants have been. And if you're a queer immigrant, forget it. You know what I mean? Your life is over, practically, to certain people. But to me, it's like, what is the... You know, my dad was in the closet, and he was a general in the American Army. He was a good guy. When I came out, he let me know he went down the path of heterosexuality because he could, and it was easier, and I should do the same. And I'm like, Dad, it's a different time. I love you. Thank you. But he supported gays in the military, even in the closet. He was a fair-minded person saying, they're already there. Gays in the U.S. military was not a big deal. It was absorbed very easily. Trans people, not a big deal. Because when you're in a war, you don't care where someone's from or what they look like. They got your back, right? That trans person's got your back. You're not questioning their race or gender in the middle of that situation.
But yet it came to mean so much to the campaigners, to yeah. purity.
Yes, again, purity of what you're supposed to
be. Is purity always cruel?
I think it is because it's not real.
Yeah.
It's like... I call the binary, the gender binary, the binarchy. You know, it's like we all have flowing energies that might be called masculine or feminine. Why crush them? You know, it's like a bird dying in your wall. If you let something die that's in you, that's very strong, there's hell to pay. Closet cases are not fun to hang out with.
And they, I don't know. I think I was amusing. I think I, you know, I kept them. Spirits of a party up.
Were you a closet case?
For oh, fuck yes, of course.
But you know what I mean. You weren't at your best, right? You weren't
no.
flowing.
I'm at my best now in my
Me too.
Late old age.
I am too. I feel better now at 63 than I've ever felt.
John, you are a member of a very, very interesting group. You are an army brat.
Yeah.
I am very interested in the kids of the generals and the admirals, or indeed, you know, the kids of the sailors, who grew up in the military community. Now, what do you think growing up in the military community has given you that you still value now?
Socialism for rednecks. That's what
Explain yourself.
The military in the U.S. is millions of people working in a socialist culture that's meritocratic. Everyone's from everywhere. No one is judging you by what you look like or where you're from. It might be a conversation starter, but ultimately it's like, what do you got to bring to the party here? That's also theaters like that too. So that's just why I love it. We lived all over the world. Military people are not nationalist in that narrow Nazi way, you know, that white nationalist way, because mm-hmm. it's wildly mixed. Because we have free health care, which we don't have in the U.S. We have... cheaper prices for groceries. We had education, you know, GI Bill, right?
You also had responsibilities.
We had responsibilities and sometimes goals that I didn't always agree with, you know, certain missions. Yeah. And it was a bit of a macho place. Back then, I'm like, I don't belong here as a gay man. You know, like I don't belong in the military. But as I got older, I'm like, what a great way to grow up. Because I saw a lot of the world. Nothing scares me that's new. I miss... finding a deep roots with a home, but I learned fairness. I learned a joy in collaboration. I don't care where you're from, let's muck in and make it happen, which is theater. It's also New Orleans, where I live, which is a wildly diverse place too that never judges because it's a port town. The whole city's in drag. You know, Mardi Gras, I've never seen a homophobic thing there. You might expect it because it's a southern town. But even the MAGA people who come into Bourbon Street in you know, during Mardi Gras, they're looking for a fight, but people just hand them a beer and say, welcome. And they stop fighting. And they look at a drag queen and say, I want to take a picture with them. You know, things settle when you are celebrating, let's say.
Doesn't sound like a very pure town to me.
It's a dirty town that's falling apart. But it's a real town, and it's a hospitable town. People say, come on in. What do you got to bring to the party? And it's sincere. It's not LA where you're like, I'm not sure what they really mean. It's not you, New York, where they're cold but warm underneath it. It's warm on the surface. It's take your time, talk to a stranger. The city's infrastructure is crumbling, but it's beautiful. I live in a 180-year-old house I bought from an occult church with a 50-foot ballroom with the David Bowie stained glass window in my chapel.
But you need it. But you need that.
I need that. And the church I grew up in, hardcore Catholic stuff, even that from a distance, I can go, the guilt was bad, but I love the good works. I love the feeling of taking care of your neighborhood. I want to know my neighbors.
And the music?
Yes, though at the time in the 70s, it was the guitar mass moment, you know, where it was like songs from Jesus Christ Superstar in church, which was funny to see my closeted dad singing, and I've had so many men before and very... It's like he was horrified. But he also was a beloved figure. He wanted me to join him. And I was like, Dad, it's not for me. And then he came on set for Rabbit Hole when I'm directing Nicole Kidman. And at the end of the day, he said, you do exactly what I do.
John, thank you for joining us on Late Night Live. John Cameron Mitchell is talking, appearing around the place. All the details of that will be up on our website.
Great.
But he starts at the Melbourne Film Festival this Friday with a 25th anniversary screening of Hedwig and the Angry Inch. Unmissable, ladies and gentlemen. Next, the sorry story of the Wyndham Native Hospital. Until the 1960s, Wyndham, on the far north coast of Western Australia, had two hospitals, the white one in town and the native hospital 3 miles out. It was apartheid, and Wyndham wasn't the only place in WA giving different care to white and to Aboriginal patients. The native hospital at 3 Mile was also a place of incarceration, designed, they said at the time, to protect whites from black diseases. The survival of this system for so long is the theme of Annabel Stafford's book, The Wanted and the Unwanted. Annabel is a teacher these days, but she was a journalist writing for papers like The Age and The Financial Review and journals like Griffith Review and Meanjin. Annabel, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you very much for having me.
Your grandfather was a doctor.
Yes, that's right.
And in 1937, his ship called at Wyndham.
Yes, so he was on his way to London as the ship's doctor. And in fact, my grandmother was also a ship's doctor. She followed him a little bit later. And he was writing letters to her as he went to London. And I was reading those letters. And in 1937, the ship stopped at Wyndham, which is right up the top of Western Australia. And he was taken to a newly built native hospital, which had been built 3 miles out of town. And he wrote to my grandmother that it had been built there because the, quote, natives were not allowed in town unless absolutely necessary. And so this had been kind of a separate place for them, yeah.
And what shocked you, I think, was your sense of both your grandparents being highly ethical, modern medical practitioners.
Yeah, so my grandmother was one of the early, you know, women to go through medicine at Sydney University. She was a, you know, a feminist, progressive, and they both, yeah, were, I thought, you know, really enlightened, progressive people. And I was also just shocked myself that I had not known that there were these types of hospitals.
And there was no protest in your grandfather's letter. It was just a matter of fact. The race system out here is very strong.
Yes.
Yeah, they don't like them in town. Yeah.
Yes.
So there was the bluntness of it.
Yes, it was this sort of, I think William Stanners said, and he's the famous sort of anthropologist who talks about the Great Australian Silence, he says there's this curious lack of...
Forgetting.
Yes.
The Great Australian Forgetting.
Oh, the Great Australian Forgetting, yes, yes. Yeah, which is an active thing, isn't it? Yeah. Mm. Yeah, so he talks about this lack of declamation, or we just see it as sort of the normal part of life. This is just how it is.
I didn't know about apartheid medical systems. I really didn't. So this is a fresh discovery for me, but then I know. I know so little.
But I know so little. I reported on Indigenous affairs in my job as a journalist. So frankly, I sort of felt ashamed. Like, how could I not know that this had happened in my grandparents' lifetime?
Okay, well, let's look at the system. The fundamental argument seems to be, look, it's inevitable. We have to have two hospitals because the natives aren't allowed in town. But as grim as that was that in fact a cover for the fact that the natives, I'll use that expression for the moment, were to be given very different treatment?
Yes. So I think, first of all, the fact that natives were not allowed in town was the result of, well, two things. One, a pastoral system that relied on either free or very cheap labour to survive. And so
Black labour,
which people at that time were calling slavery, and I think with cause. And so I think they wanted to limit the number of places that Aboriginal people could be. Therefore, they're forced to work in these places. So that's one thing. And then they also didn't want white men and Black women having sex. So this was a big driver of the hospital. They started mentioning it about 1928 and they were sort of getting worried about venereal disease. Now, they hadn't been worried about venereal disease really until white men started turning up with it. And then it was a really big problem.
But how did having separate hospitals deal with venereal disease?
Well, it kept Aboriginal women away from white men. That's how it dealt with venereal disease. But as at least one doctor sort of said, before white men sort of started turning up with it, gonorrhea was kind of left to run rampant through. And gonorrhea was known to cause infertility, but there was this idea that Aboriginal people were dying out, quote unquote, which was this sort of eugenically shaded concept of the stronger races surviving or whatever. So
yes.
It was explained away.
The Darwinian notion.
Yeah, Darwinian notion. But in fact, you know, if you know gonorrhea causes infertility and you turn a blind eye, you don't treat it, you are essentially sterilising people.
But gonorrhea becomes a problem when white people come to the district because you don't want white people to have gonorrhea.
Yes, correct.
But is there evidence of how prevalent venereal disease was in Wyndham?
So this doctor called Dr. Webster arrived sort of in 1930 and he is, as well as being the district medical officer, he's also the magistrate of the town and the protector of Aborigines. Usually that was a role given to police, but he seems to have been the first doctor there that does that as well. And he writes in his first report that like 99% of Aboriginal people in his estimation have this disease and about 90% of white men and that he knows of a few white men who are infectious and they're knocking around the bush, sleeping with people. Yeah.
Right. So that is there and the notion is that if you separate black and white into two separate hospitals, this will in some way prevent the spread of venereal disease. But were blacks and whites being given the same treatment for venereal disease?
No. So, I mean, they weren't being given the same treatment for anything, just the fact that you have a native hospital where there's not a doctor on site. So the doctor was located at the district hospital. The native hospital was run by a matron and a manager. There was hardly any accommodation apart from some locked wards. So when the hospital was finally built, which was not till 1937, there were separate wards for people, for men and women with venereal disease. They were locked up at night. They were kept there indefinitely. They weren't always receiving treatment, whereas for white people there was sort of treatment out the back in a shed.
In town.
In town, yeah.
Yes, yep. Yes. Mm. What about leprosy?
Yes, so leprosy, there's been a lot of work done on leprosy by a lot of great historians. One, Alison Bashford's written a lot about this and talks about how the way that leprosy was treated in the Kimberley and in Australia was a really conflated race and disease. And it was seen as a kind of an Aboriginal disease in some way. And at Wyndham, people were kind of kept in these like tin huts that one matron was really distressed and said, like, at 40 degrees heat, it's like an oven. And I can't keep them here. So she said she sort of sent them off, tried to send the people to the leprosarium, which was where they were keeping lepers, early because, you know, she couldn't keep them locked up in this little hut. And some of the people that I talked to remembered seeing the people with leprosy stuck in these huts and the food would go in under a space in the door. And in 1940, there was the institution of something called a leper line at the 20th parallel.
The leper line.
The leper line. And it was the 20th parallel, so sort of across the top part of WA. And Alison Bashford points this out. It was Aboriginal people who were not allowed to go south of it, not lepers. So it was sort of seen, you know, it was just conflated like it was a disease of race or something.
Mm. Yeah. On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr and I'm talking to Annabelle Stafford about her new book, The Wanted and the Unwanted, about the apartheid medical system in northern Western Australia. Annabelle, the Aboriginal people knew that you got better treatment in town. Mm. And when they were desperate, they tried to get it. Mm. Tell us about that and how successful they were.
Yes. So, like, from about 1928, there's these reports in the archives of white doctors in town saying, you know, these Aboriginal people have travelled in from Forest River Mission, which was on the site of a place then called Ombulgari. And it took a long time, I think, to get from there to Wyndham. So one of the doctors says, you know, having heard something about the possibility of a cure, and these people had, I think he said granuloma, which is a sort of like ulceration in the genital area and like, you know, painful, horrible stuff. He says, you know, they've heard about the possibility of the cure and now they've come in, but there's no place to put them in the White Hospital. I can't put them in the yard. And, you know, the medical staff have got enough going on without having to supervise the comings and goings of natives. So they were just not treated, I think. I think it depended on the doctor. Some doctors may have treated Aboriginal people, but it would have been outside of the building itself, so they would have had to be in a little tent in the yard or something like that. Mm.
So building a hospital for the natives was actually it was actually a benevolent gesture.
Yes, so it's all very tangled. So
it always is.
Yeah. I think for, you know, there were a lot of people who were motivated by the wish to actually treat people. However, there were also people motivated by wanting to treat certain people as cheaply and as easily and as, you know, with little risk to themselves. So the pastoralists, they could, there was a thing introduced around that time as well called the Native Medical Fund. Pastoralists could pay into that £1 per native per year. And if they paid into that, then that defrayed any kind of cost of workers' compensation. So they get a pretty good deal. And then
that offered some sort of basic medical care.
Yes, basic medical care, but again, it was quite the legal sort of wording around it meant that a lot of pastoralists could get away with just turning someone out as soon as they got sick. And so you still get in the archives these instances of people turning up to the hospital really on death's door. They've been sort of left to, left with the disease, or of pastoralists saying, well, they didn't actually work for me. They were just sort of camping nearby.
Mm. Mm. So they turned up at the native hospital and they were treated?
Yes, I think some were treated, yeah. So this was after kind of 1937. People would turn up to the hospital and were treated. And then there were, you know, periods of time where People were treated well. But even when the hospital had been running for a few years, one of the government medical officers sort of wrote and said, I mean, what were we thinking when we built this hospital? Because there's actually no patient accommodation. It's just there's a couple of sheds where people can get locked up at night, and then there's, you know, the big house, but there's, you know, there's really nowhere to put people. So
there weren't wards and beds.
No, there was no beds at all. And the wards were like a couple of huts. They weren't wards in any sense. And where patients would be put in the kind of, I suppose, treatment area, there was a veranda where the cot cases or the, you know, the people who were very ill would be put. There was only one veranda. The other three parts of the veranda were just not built, like they just got left. And so people kept writing going, can you please build the extra verandas? We don't have enough places to put the patients. So they have like a pregnant woman next to a person with sepsis. You know, it was crowded, the rain's coming in at night, there's, you know, mosquitoes. Like it was, yeah, not at all like the White Hospital.
You begin the book with an account of a woman in 1959 with a very sick baby, realising it needs treatment and going to the White Hospital in town. What happened?
Yes, so she went to the White Hospital in town and she was told by the nurse that was on duty that the doctor wouldn't see her. She needed to go to the Native Hospital. So she goes back to the Native Hospital and where the officials sort of say, no, the child needs to go back to the hospital. You know, it was getting sicker and sicker. So one of the white welfare officers takes the baby back to the hospital, the White Hospital. It's nighttime now. She's standing on the veranda of the hospital. The night sister, who's the same sister from before, says to her, no, the doctor can't see you. You need to go to the Native Hospital. The baby has bronchitis. It's coughing and it just sort of stopped breathing in her arms. And so then the nurse brought the baby inside after it was dead and, you know, declared it had died, and the doctor was called. Yeah.
The doctor was there.
Yes. So what the welfare officer said in his report was that it was just a cover. He just didn't want to see the baby. And later on that doctor defended himself by saying, well, these people are native in law, they should have gone to the Native Hospital, which of course they did, but there's no doctor at the Native Hospital.
But he was made to answer for himself, the doctor.
Well, he was defended by the public health officials who said, you know, it is actually, you know, he is right in saying that these people should be treated at the Native Hospital. So to answer for himself, I mean, he had to make an explanation, but nothing else happened. I mean, if that had happened to a white baby, you know, possibly certainly they'd think about your practice certificate, I would have thought.
When did the system break down? When I say break down, when did the system get fixed?
Well, I think it was a sort of slow process. So one factor was that the British Medical Association, who had doctors in, you know, all their doctors in Australia, they were saying, well, we should get paid if we're going to have to treat Aboriginal people as well in the hospitals, we should get paid the same amount for white people and Aboriginal people. And so then...
So just a minute. Let's pause there for a moment. So the treatment of Aboriginal people was cut price.
Yes.
Right. You didn't get as much money for treating an Aboriginal person.
No.
No. Righto.
So why would you do it? Presumably.
Continue.
Yes. So then that was one factor in sort of saying, well, there's no difference in the prices, therefore, yes, you can also, I suppose, you know, we shouldn't bar Aboriginal people from white hospitals. Then the other factor was, I think, just the changing industrial situation as well. So after the war, well, during the war, a lot of pastoralists who had relied on kind of cheap labour or unpaid labour were suddenly faced with a growing workforce that knew they were actually of value, and they said, well, we're not going to work for no money anymore or less money. We want to be paid better. And then there was, you know, a lot of strikes. So the workers really fought for their rights. And I think that also changed the system a little bit. But then I think a big part of it was the changing citizenship rights. So as long as people were designated as a native in law, then they didn't have rights like habeas corpus or, you know, if you were a white person and you were forced into treatment for venereal disease, after 2 weeks you could ask for an appeal, you know, appeal your case. If you were native, you were just incarcerated forever if you needed to be, yeah.
So whites were incarcerated for venereal disease?
Well, not really. They were, during this period, people could make a report of someone that they suspected of having venereal disease. That person could be required to have treatment, but they could just have the treatment as an outpatient. The treatment was free. If they absconded from treatment, then the doctor would have to tell the public health officials their name. But if they were found not to have it, they could find out who had dobbed them in and they could appeal it and all of those things. Aboriginal people, there was no free treatment. They could be examined by anyone nominated by the Chief Protector of Aborigines.
Not necessarily a doctor.
No, anybody at all, and using whatever means necessary was the wording of the regulation.
Annabel, I wonder if the change also had something to do with penicillin.
Yes, yes. So that was kind of coming in around 1940, and it was, I think it took a while for it to be available a bit more widely. I was not able to tell whether those drugs were given equally across white patients and Aboriginal patients. It was sort of difficult to tell. But at this time was also the time of the Tuskegee syphilis experiment, which was...
What's that?
So this was started in 1932 in Tuskegee, Alabama. And it started out with a, you know, kind of benevolent idea that we will treat, they were going to treat African-American people for syphilis. So they were treating people, but then the money ran out. And so some of the public health officials thought, oh, well, you know, maybe this is an opportunity to figure out what happens to African-American men who are untreated for syphilis. And so they were left untreated till I think the 70s. And the worst thing is that it was reported on in like international medical journals that they were going to follow people until autopsy was the words to see what happened.
Fair enough.
Yeah, I know. And so...
And this was happening, you think, also in Western Australia?
No, I haven't. I have to say I haven't found any evidence for that, but I would love it if someone could research that more. Mm-hmm. I couldn't find, so the different types of drugs when they came in, were they allocated to native hospitals on the same basis? The archives are quite difficult to read in some of those cases, but...
There wouldn't have been great enthusiasm for making that clear. Annabel, what's there today?
In terms of health and...
No. What's at 3 Mile? Is there anything left?
Not of the actual old hospital. So there's kind of bits of tile and things like that. But the actual proper Wyndham is around 3 Mile now, which I think is wonderful.
Wyndham has come out to 3 Mile.
Yeah, yeah. Like the actual old port, which was the white town, is kind of like a ghost town, whereas the real Wyndham is around the 3 Mile. That's where it's grown up from. And so for a while it was an Aboriginal corporation called Yuruknani, and it was, this is also, I think, fabulous. So when Vietnamese refugees first came out, they were given kind of shelter initially at the old hospital site, so it became this kind of, I don't know, just...
A camp.
Yeah, yeah, but a place of inclusion as opposed to exclusion, which I felt like it was before. And, yes, now it's just an empty site.
What's under the ground?
Yes. So several people I talked to remembered bodies being buried just on the perimeter of the old hospital. Or one of the men that I talked to, Reg Birch, his dad used to be the, I'll put it in a euphemistic, the poo can truck driver. So he used to go
night
and get soil. The
night soil,
sorry.
Please, Annabelle. Night soil, we call it on Night Late Soil. Night Live.
Night Soil. And every now and again there would be a body to collect from the native hospital.
By the Night Soil Man.
And the body was buried in a kind of an unmarked grave.
And the Night Soil Man had a kid as an offsider. And what was the kid told to do?
Yes, so he had a bag that his mum had kind of made for him, and his dad would say, put on your bag so that he wouldn't have to see the corpses. But he still got nightmares, as did another woman that I spoke to who was in the hospital as a patient. And he's drawn these pictures of the old cart with the body on the back.
But what a perfect expression, put on the bag.
I know.
And it's still happening. We're still putting on the bag.
Yes, we are.
But you've ripped off the bag with this.
I think I've started to, but there's so much more. Like, I just keep being shocked by all this stuff that went on. And that's out there. You know, lots of people have done work on this, but I think it should be more widely known about. I think, if we keep putting on the bag, we're culpable in a way too. We're disremembering. Yeah.
And it will be remembered. And more people will now know of it because of your book, The Wanted and the Unwanted, by A.M. Stafford, not Annabelle Stafford. No.
No.
A.M. Stafford, published by Melbourne University Press. Annabelle, thank you very much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's the show and the week. So it's time for Chatterbox. Now, look, last week I made an impassioned plea for someone out there to send us a fax. The details of how to contact us by fax are there all the time on the Late Night Live website. I wanted to see them used. Now, I have to turn at this point to producer Catherine Zengerer for the story of the fax that came. Catherine, what happened?
Well, David, last week I got a mysterious text from Matt Stevens of L&L Fax Machine fame, and he told me that he had followed your request and sent us a fax.
Great, great.
So I said, okay, well, let me see if I can find out where this fax went. So I went to our admin coordinator and she just looked at me and said, we don't have a fax machine. We haven't had one for years. They used to go to the breakfast team. She said, maybe you should go down to the mail room.
Yes.
So I went down to the mail room, which is deep in the bowels of the ABC Ultimo building.
Intestines.
It's kind of hidden, like troglodytes or something, yep. Far, far away. And I went down to talk to them and they said, we don't know what you're talking about. We haven't had a fax machine for years. We just don't have one. They said, maybe you should go and talk to our tech, like the tech help desk people.
Good thinking.
And they just said, we have no idea. You're going to have to follow up with our telephony people.
Right. Okay.
So we now have a request in with our telephony experts to try and find out where faxes go. And you'll have to basically tune in next week to Chatterbox for an update on our quest to find the facts.
I can't wait. Personally, I can't wait. Catherine, thank you for that detective work and thank you for your work as a producer on Late Night Live. Thanks to all of the team, to Catherine, to Ali Benton, to Anne Arnold and Julie Street, and to our executive producer, Jack Schmidt. Until next week.